From 90.9 WBUR, I'm Anthony Brooks. This is Radio Boston. Coming up, fiber optics are revolutionizing the power of the internet across much of Asia, but here in America, not so much.
South Koreans feel that coming to the United States is like taking a peaceful rural vacation because life is so unconnected here.
Harvard Law School's Susan Crawford on the coming tech revolution and why America might miss it. Also today, the Republican tax plan and why millions of Americans can expect smaller refunds this year. Plus, a Black History Month effort to help Boston's Black-owned restaurants.
That's the biggest challenge, is getting people to understand that everyone is welcome. There's no only people of the neighborhood, only people that look like the owner or the employees can go there. That is the biggest challenge.
And checking in on the world of sports, from the bean pot to spring training. That's all coming up next on Radio Boston.
Thanks for listening to the Radio Boston podcast. If you'd like to support WBUR, go to radioboston.org and click the pledge button in the upper right-hand corner. Okay, back to the show.
This is Radio Boston. I'm Anthony Brooks, and we'll begin today with one of the two things none of us can avoid: taxes. Tax filing season is upon us, and millions of Americans are learning or will soon learn that their refund checks are significantly smaller than last year. In fact, after years of receiving refunds, many folks might even owe money to the IRS. And many blame President Trump and the Republican tax bill signed into law in 2017 and are venting with the hashtag GOP tax scam. But wait, thanks to that tax bill, the vast majority of Americans received a tax cut last year. So what's going on? Well, to help us with that question and others, let's turn to Evan Horowitz. He's the Director of Research and Communications for the financial think tank FCLT Global. Evan, great to see you. Thanks for coming in.
Anthony, it's amazing to be back here with you.
Amazing.
It is. It's amazing.
It's amazing.
I love being
to have
here with you.
Well, okay. So let's start with some numbers. Tell us what the IRS says about those refund checks. How much lower are they expected to be?
Well, getting mixed messages from the IRS. They're expected to be about 8% lower. That is, so far, we've had a couple of weeks now since the government restarted of refunds being processed. They seem to be a little bit lower, about 8% lower. But the administration is kind of spinning this and saying, well, that's not really lower, and they're not really lower compared to 2017. The key thing, I think, to take away from this is, like, refunds are not a good measure of anything. Like, I could guarantee every one of your listeners a $1 million refund.
Right.
Just guarantee it. All you have to do is overpay your taxes by $1 million through the course of the year, and you will get $1 million refund. If that sounds like a silly thing to do, it probably is, but that's what refunds are.
Right.
They're not an indication of how much you've paid in taxes. They're just an indication of how much you overpaid during the year.
Okay. So the more important fact probably is this, that most people got a tax cut last year, right?
I think the more important economic fact is that, yes, that about 80% of people got a tax cut under the GOP plan. Now, the bulk of those cuts did go to the wealthiest. It was not evenly distributed, but 4 in 5 households or so got a tax cut. Now, I say that's the most important economic fact, but the psychology of this really does seem to matter to people.
Mm-hmm.
People hate losing out on a refund, or, God forbid, having to pay extra when their tax bill comes up in April. There's this well-known phenomenon, loss aversion, that is, it hurts me much more when you take $10 away from me than any kind of pleasure I might get from getting $10. Losses are really painful, and the prospect of losing what you expect really hurts people. So there's this economic side to it, where people are better off. There's the psychological side, where people are really frustrated.
Right. So now most people, as you say, 4 out of 5 houses received a tax cut in 2018, but didn't change their withholdings, then it stands to reason that their refunds would be small.
So that's what went wrong.
Right.
I mean, that's basically what went
wrong.
Okay,
I understand.
The tax cut went into effect, and the administration said, well, now people are going to pay less in taxes, so we should change how much taxes we take out of their paychecks, right? But unfortunately, companies didn't know how much to take out, because there's lots of detail in the new tax law that the companies just didn't know about you. For instance, there's now a cap on the amount of the deduction you can take for your state income and property taxes, right? But your company doesn't know about that. Your company doesn't know how much you're claiming in state property tax. So they kind of have to guess, how much should we withhold? And the guidance that they got from the IRS suggested they'd be pretty aggressive about limiting withholding so people get more in their paycheck. But now that's coming due. If people didn't have enough withheld because companies didn't know about them. That's why they're going to owe more or they're going to get a smaller refund.
Right. So another interesting thing that I want to ask you about the psychology of a refund or getting a smaller refund than you're used to. I mean, as you suggest, it disappoints people. On the other hand, a large tax refund isn't necessarily a good thing because doesn't that mean that you're essentially giving the government a tax-free loan.
That's exactly right. So you kind of have to balance these things out. As I say, the economic fact is if you're getting a big refund, it's because you lent the government a lot of money at zero interest for most of the year.
Right.
Lots of people probably don't want to do that. I know, for instance, my dad feels very strongly about this. He does not want to overpay by 1 cent and would much rather owe at the end of the year. Me, I am totally on the other side of this. I'm deeply loss averse, and crazy as it sounds, I would much rather overpay so that when April comes along, I get a refund or don't owe money. So in my case, the psychology really outweighs the economics of it. And I think that's true for a lot of people. In fact, in most years, the majority of Americans do overpay and enjoy a refund.
All right. So to be clear, 80% of people filing taxes got a tax cut because of the Republican tax bill. But is there still a political problem here for Republicans? I mean, there was a lot of talk that the party could run on the success of the tax cuts. Now people are seeing a drop in the refund or in some cases even owing money. I mean, I understand why. You've explained that really well. But what do you make of the politics of lower tax refunds?
I do think it's dicey for Republicans because people fetishize their tax refunds.
Right.
So and it's not just Republicans. I mean, the Democrats made this mistake or the same got themselves into the same trap, let's say, a few years ago. At the time of the Great Recession, there was a sort of push for Democratic stimulus in the form of tax cuts. But geniuses in the Democratic Party decided that the most effective form of stimulus would be to provide a tax cut that people didn't notice.
Huh.
If they didn't notice it, their paychecks got just a little bit bigger. They were much more likely to spend it. Now, there's a lot of research showing that was true, and it turned out to be true. People did spend it more, and it was more effective as stimulus. However, people didn't know about it. So the Obama administration, the Democrats, didn't get any credit for the tax cut that they provided because people never felt that they received a tax cut. And I think Republicans have gotten themselves into kind of the same corner. They have provided a real benefit in terms of tax relief for tens of millions of Americans. But come April, lots of those Americans who benefited will actually feel that they lost out. And it's probably the feeling that is the more significant political factor and could definitely limit the impact, any beneficial impact Republicans could expect from their tax cuts at the polls.
So it's understandable how people are venting. We mentioned in the introduction this hashtag GOP tax scam. What would be the competing, the sort of rebuttal to that hashtag?
I think the rebuttal is like, that's just opportunistic. You know, lots of people oppose the GOP for all
hashtag,
kinds of reasons.
Hashtag, I think that's just opportunistic.
Hashtag activism
really have
is sometimes opportunistic and not well-researched. I think the
we need to work on that one, Evan.
The pushback is just, let's look at what percentage people are really paying. When you go through it, most people really did see a benefit of the tax cuts. I mean, there are ways the Democrats could push back on that because, as I said earlier, like not everyone got the same benefits.
Right.
But Republicans could counter. Refunds are really not the way to think about it. The way to think about it is, what was your effective tax rate? And for most Americans, their effective tax rate over the course of 2018 was lower.
Okay. Evan Horowitz, Director of Research and Communications at FCLT Global, a financial think tank here in Boston. Evan, thanks so much for coming in.
As I said, it's amazing to be here.
It's amazing to have you. So let's move on from taxes to another right of this late winter season, spring training and the world of sports, which we talk about on most Wednesdays. Radio Boston's own Chris Siderick is with us. And Chris, good to have you here.
Yeah, good to be here. Thanks, Anthony.
All right, we'll get to spring training. But first, I know the Red Sox, the Patriots have both captured titles in the last few months. There's another team in town that was supposed to be a big title contender, and that's the Boston Celtics. How are things going for them so far?
Well, if you had asked me this yesterday, I would have said the sky is falling. So
right.
I'm glad we're talking about this today. The Celtics had a big win last night against the Philadelphia 76ers. I say it's a big win because they were coming off a two-game losing streak, which doesn't sound like much, but those were two really bad losses last Thursday to the Lakers and Saturday to the Clippers. In both those games, the Celtics were up big and blew these big leads to end up losing. And it was kind of a microcosm for what's gone on with this team all year. They've really struggled with chemistry and guys knowing their roles. And that really comes down to the three young guys, Jason Tatum, Jaylen Brown, and Terry Rozier. And it's kind of understandable when you think about what happened. These guys, those three, led this team to the Eastern Conference Finals last year, Game 7, basically 4 minutes away from the title game. They eventually got beat by LeBron and the Cavs. But they all played huge roles and stepped up to the moment. Now, Gordon Hayward is back from injury, Kyrie Irving is back from injury, and those guys have taken those minutes away. These three young guys have less opportunity. They're trying to figure out how to still shine in the moments they get, but honestly, they're struggling with how to figure it out.
Interesting. Still, that win last night against Philadelphia, pretty big deal, right? Because Philly's supposed to be one of the better teams.
Yeah, they're one of the better teams, and they got better at the trade deadline, unlike the Celtics. They didn't really make any big moves. Philly brought in Tobias Harris, who's an excellent three-point shooter. That was one of their weaknesses. But the Celtics have done really well against the 76ers in the past. And you saw this kind of energy and this lockdown defense last night that really we haven't seen from the Celtics throughout the year. So that is an encouraging sight for sure.
So big question, is this team, this version of the Celtics, a title contender? And what do they need to make a successful run?
Well, I would say they are a title contender if they can play like they played last night. They've got to bring that energy and that effort.
Right.
You saw great ball movement last night, those quick passes, finding the open look. They were great on help defense. If one guy gets burned, the next guy steps up to make the play. And so they really need to capture that energy and that effort. That's really going to be the key. An interesting stat, Kyrie Irving, we mentioned already, he was out last night. This team with Kyrie in the lineup is 28-19. They're 8-2 without him. Really interesting.
That is interesting. Now, why? I mean, he's supposed to be one of the best players in the league, right? I mean, those, wait, say again, 28-19 with him.
Yeah.
Without him,
8-2. So small sample size, first of all. And he is one of the best players in the league. He is incredibly talented, and he has played well this year. But there's something about having him on the floor. So much of the offense flows through him that guys are struggling a bit to kind of find where they fit in the system. And that can take away from, honestly, the fun of the game. Marcus Morris was talking to reporters after the 28-point lead that the Celts blew on Saturday. And basically, they got booed off the court by their own fans. Here he is.
For me, it's not really about the loss. It's about the attitudes that we're playing with. You know, guys are, you know, hanging their heads. It just doesn't, it's not fun, man. Like, it's not fun. We're not competing at a high level. You know, even though we're winning, it's still not, it's not fun. You know, I don't see the joy in the game.
Yeah, it doesn't sound very joyful.
Yeah, you can hear it in his voice, right?
Yeah.
And I mean, you know this, Anthony.
Right.
Teams are better when guys are out there having fun, working together. And he did say after the win last night, that was fun.
All right, so really quickly, another Boston team that will probably be heading to the postseason this April are the Boston Bruins. Give us your quick take on them.
The Bruins are in a decent spot. The hockey, first of all, as long as you get into the playoffs, you have a chance to win the title. It is a much more topsy-turvy kind of playoff system. They right now are holding third in their division. They're squarely in the playoffs. The question will be, do they make a move before the NHL trade deadline, which is February 25th? They just lost David Pastrnak. He's their leading goal scorer. And the Bruins GM, Don Sweeney, is kind of grappling with this question of, do we bring in a rental player? Do we give up cheap young talent in order to bring a guy who's only going to be here for a short window? They basically did that last year with Rick Nash under the assumption they'd be able to sign him long term. Rick Nash ended up getting a serious concussion and ended up retiring. So Don Sweeney has said he's not sure he wants to make that move for just a one-year player.
All right. So I want to make sure that we touch on this. I want to make sure that we mention briefly while we're talking hockey that BU has some major celebrating to do after the women's team won the Beanpot last night. Right.
First women's hockey team win for BU since 1981, and it's their first win as a varsity team. They were actually just a club team in 81. They took down Harvard last night 3-2 in overtime. Junior Sammy Davis got the game-winning goal, and I love it. She said the team motto for this season has been, do it for the ladies of the 80s.
All right.
Great win there.
Great win. All right, indeed. Okay, so I saved the best for last. I want to talk about spring training.
I knew this one was in your wheelhouse.
Right in my wheelhouse. But, I mean, here we are, midwinter. But, you know, signs of spring. Days are getting a little longer. Pitchers and catchers have reported What do you see down there from Florida?
Well, this is going to be interesting. I love a title defense. That's one of my favorite storylines in sports. Can you come back from the greatest moment of euphoria and do it again? Because it starts over in that grind. You know, in baseball, is tough.
It is tough.
So their season starts March 28th. The home opener is April 9th. There are a lot of questions facing this team, from the bullpen to the starting rotation. It'll be really interesting to see kind of how they approach the year.
All right. Well, lots to watch. Radio Boston's Chris Sidorek bringing us up to date with the world of sports. Chris, thanks so much.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
Listeners, stay with us. Coming up, would you like to see municipal internet in your town? We're going to be talking about the coming tech revolution and fiber optics and why America might be missing it. Stay with us. I'm Anthony Brooks. This is Radio Boston.
Wait a second.
Don't hit the skip button.
I mean, we know you do it.
We just wanted to take a second here because you already know how to download a podcast.
But you might have a question about some of the other technology you use, and we think we can help.
WBUR is working on a new show, and we're here to answer your tech questions, whether it's hardware-related,
software-related, social, even ethical.
Just click that little phone-shaped app on your cell phone and give us a call. Leave a message, 617-917-4717.
Give it a try, 617-917-4717.
Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Anthony Brooks. The world of fiber optics is expanding the reach and power of the internet and has the potential to revolutionize our homes and businesses. Fiber optics carry virtually unlimited amounts of data and will radically transform healthcare, education, stores, and the way our cities and towns are administered. According to my next guest, it's a change that will rival the advent of electricity. But she argues it's a tech revolution that America is at risk of missing. Susan Crawford is a professor at Harvard Law School and served as President Obama's special assistant for science, technology, and innovation policy. Her new book is called Fiber, The Coming Tech Revolution and Why America Might Miss It. Susan Crawford, welcome to Radio Boston. Thanks for coming in.
It's great to be here.
It's really good to have you. And listeners, we want to get you involved in this conversation about the fiber optic revolution. What kind of internet is available in your own city? Should high-speed internet be a right available to all citizens? How do we make that happen? Give us a call at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. And feel free to call if you just have questions about this really fascinating conversation. So, Susan, let's start with a basic definition here. We hear cable companies like Verizon, Fios talk about fiber. Tell us what it is. What is fiber and why does it matter?
So fiber, there's a lot of it, by the way, already running between cities in America and between the continent of North America and other continents. What it is very, very pure synthetically printed glass through which lasers shoot pulses of light carrying information. Once the glass is in the ground, the science of photonics is advancing very quickly. And as far as we can tell, the amount of information that can be sent through glass for kilometers, tens of kilometers, without being encouraged or amplified is unlimited.
Unlimited. So how does that compare to what's going on now? Well, now we're basically, or the older technology, we're dealing with what? Cable.
Cable, which is a hybrid fiber coaxial lines.
Right.
Look, the difference is if you're sitting at home trying to participate in a business meeting, right now using a cable connection, it does not feel to you as if there is just a pane of glass
right
between you and the meeting. You're not actually able to participate. The difference with fiber is this very high capacity, enormous amounts of information allow for human presence. And cable can't be upgraded the way that fiber can to these unlimited numbers of bits. And around the world, and especially in Asia and in the Nordics, fiber connections between, let's say, city nodes and homes and businesses are common. That's the way things work, but not here in America.
And that's what you mean by this last mile, right?
Exactly. Right. That's the most expensive part of any telecommunications network.
From the nodes to essentially my living room.
Exactly.
Got it. All right. So let me put it this way. So I live in Somerville, and my internet feels plenty fast. I watch Netflix, watch videos, upload photos on my phone. I can stay in touch with work, usually. Why should I be concerned about not having that last mile of fiber?
Let me draw a parallel for you.
Yeah.
In the early days of electricity, people thought that having one light bulb was all anybody would ever need.
They couldn't imagine that anything else was ever going to happen. Same thing here. You're downloading Netflix, but it's very difficult for you to actually be with a doctor, be in a classroom, be part of anything, exchanging very large files rich with data. There will be new industries, new ways of making a living, new ways of surviving the 21st century, especially given climate change, that will require tremendous connections to homes and businesses, and you don't have that in Somerville.
Wow. Interesting. And you begin. I want to actually just get you to describe a little bit where your book begins, because you traveled to South Korea and in 2018 during the Olympics there.
Actually, it was before the Olympics.
Before
it was the August before the March Olympics,
right.
The Winter Olympics. So I was in a very hot ice skating stadium.
Right.
But they were demonstrating to me what was possible with the fiber plus very advanced wireless services that Korea Telecom had installed in Pyeongchang. And it was really something.
So what did you see? What was so remarkable about it?
Well, the idea of being able to take the view of an athlete in an event, be actually with that person, able to feel almost what they're feeling, is extraordinary. And that's what these connections make possible, to slice and dice events in any way you want to as a viewer and understand and slow down turns so you can see it again. Mm. Also, I was really moved by the idea there in the Winter Olympics Village of a driverless bus guided by tsunamis of data that are telling it where to go and where to turn. On the windows of the bus, projected images or information about what you're seeing outside. And you're able to, in effect, communicate with the world around you through the windows of the bus. And that's pretty neat, too.
It's extraordinary. If I recall correctly, I think there was a moment when you actually thought you were going to run into somebody, right? And the bus actually did what it needed to do.
Well, and driverless buses are becoming more common in Asia. They rely on these very high-capacity networks. And they would make sense in the Boston area, for example, in the Longworth area, as a shuttle between lots of people and public transit. But in order to do those kinds of things, you have to have very advanced networks in place that are open to many different kinds of uses. And that's another thing we don't have in the United States.
Mm. So talk a little bit about, and let's stick with South Korea for the purposes of this part of the conversation. Talk about what they're doing in South Korea that is not being done here. First of all, we were talking about that last mile, right?
Yeah.
They're doing that last mile.
Yes, they've done it. So there is fiber reaching every corner of South Korea. And there are a lot of very hilly, inaccessible rural areas of South Korea.
Yeah.
They assume fantastic wireless connectivity. They never drop calls. It's everything simply works. It's hard to describe the difference in feeling. You never think about the cost of or the availability of access to the internet. It's just there. And it's cheap. Years ago, the South Korean government, with a lot of encouragement from Samsung, installed what's called dark fiber. So that's the glass that I described, but without the lasers lighting it up with data. And it's everywhere, and that allows for a huge retail market of competitors using that fiber to provide services directly to customers. Basically, everything functions in South Korea, and it's not just telecom, it's also high-speed rail and other things the United States doesn't do. And what got me started on this journey was that South Koreans told me that coming to the United States feels as if they're taking a rural vacation. And I heard that a few times, and I'm so proud to be an American, and we think of ourselves as so exceptional. It seemed important to me to tell this story in an as approachable way as I possibly could.
It's really astounding to hear that anecdote, though, isn't it? I mean, yeah. As a kid, I spent part of my life growing up in Europe. We're talking about the early 70s. In those days, everyone looked to America as,
right.
You know, where this kind of technology was sort of taking root and taking off.
Mm-hmm.
And you tell a story that's very different now. The perception is very different.
And there are many trends converging here.
Yeah.
So percentage of research and development spending by the federal government as a percent of GDP has gone down by it's a quarter of what it was in 1986. So our commitment to basic research is also failing. And these two things go together, because getting government involved in ensuring that the country remains the most innovative place, that's the way it's always happened in America.
Hmm.
And post-war, especially your childhood and mine, we were the place where new things were happening. New industries were coming, and everybody had optimism about the world ahead. I still have that optimism because I know that American spirit is there, and I know that Americans at their best are never cynical. So we can do it again, but it would take leadership and the sense of a crisis, which we don't have right now.
Well, what changed between, say, the 1970s and now? Was it a sort of lack of faith in this is the kind of thing government can handle and do a good job at helping to lead in terms of the innovation?
It was a misplaced faith in the genius of the private market in infrastructure. So certainly after the Depression and all the things that happened at that point in our history, nobody would have thought that private industry left to its own devices would provide an infrastructure that everybody needs at a reasonable price. That's just not going to happen. That's not in their incentive package. But we began to believe that in recent decades, and really to think that the only thing that we value is profit making. That's happened. The companies that are selling access to us are doing extraordinarily well and controlling markets and dividing them up. Life is great for them, and I don't fault them. We haven't restrained them in any way. We've completely deregulated this entire marketplace of high-speed internet access. And what's happened then, lots of Americans are left out. Services are second rate. Rich people are paying through the nose for those second rate services. And then as a country, we are becoming less relevant. Among the OECD nations, 36 of them, we rank 25th for fiber adoption. And that's amazing. We should be looking everybody else in the rearview mirror.
Wow. Well, we're going to talk as we go forward about some communities around America that have sort of taken this on and are doing actually a really good job with it. I'm talking with Susan Crawford. Her book is Fiber, The Coming Tech Revolution and Why America Might Miss It. You can join the conversation if you've got questions or comments about all this. Give us a call at 1-800-423-8255. And let's take a call from Enfield, Connecticut. Zach is on the line. Zach, good to have you. Go ahead.
Hey, how's it going?
Very well, thanks.
Hey, so I got a question. Sorry, I forgot her name, but
Susan Crawford.
What exactly is allowing the fiber to be quicker in the other countries? Because I'm a limited energy system tech, and virtually everything I install is converted from Cat 5 to fiber. But the process of converting it with the converters slows the fiber. It's quick across the fiber, but the equipment is still the same speed as it can be. You know what I'm saying? So the internet is traveling across the fiber quickly with unlimited bandwidth, but it's slowed down by the equipment to convert it back to Cat 5 or coax or whatever equipment it is. So I was wondering what is in the other countries that's allowing their internet to be faster without having to convert it to something that allows you to access internet, like
Wi-Fi
emitter or something like that.
Yeah, Zach, I think we got it. Susan, does this get down to that last mile question?
Well, he's actually talking about something even more granular, which is the equipment that's then processing the data that's gone over the lines. And there, I mean, for one thing, there isn't a conversion to Cat 5. It is fiber all the way into the building, into the basement. And they are developing equipment that can handle much greater numbers of bits and spew them back and transmit them around. So look, they've got better gear than us. But the main thing this book is about is this infrastructure that we don't have. We just don't have it in the last mile because we haven't upgraded, by and large, to these fiber optic connections going into houses and buildings. But you're right that something that could be affecting this story is the nature of the equipment you use. That's absolutely true.
I want to talk about this eventual move toward 5G, right? I mean, this is a key part of that, right? The 5G sort of evolution isn't going to happen without fiber, right?
Right. So let me explain this. So 5G requires fiber.
Right.
Without fiber, no 5G, because the whole point of 5G is that it's very, very quickly moving frequencies of spectrum, carrying tons of information, but only over a very short distance. So between every 200 feet and every 400 feet, there needs to be a cell where there might have been in the past one every 750 feet or 1,000 feet. So that means a lot of construction of small cells all over the place and much more densely provided fiber deep into neighborhoods. What's happening in America is that the companies that plan to sell 5G are actually only aiming at making more money from their existing infrastructure and selling very highly priced premium wireless services, things like home security and smart city services. They want to have better price control. And 5G will let them do that because it will have lots of information flowing, and the operator will be in complete control of which services actually are provided over that 5G gear. Long story short, can't have 5G without fiber. We should be very careful to make sure that we don't give any one 5G carrier a monopoly over any metro area.
All right. Let's take another call. Andy is calling from Falmouth. Andy, you're on the air. Go ahead. Thanks for the call.
Yes. Hello, Susan. I was just calling. First of all, I'm a very firm believer in municipal fiber. I really don't need much convincing of its benefits. But I am looking for some advice to communicate to my friends who are definitely, I guess, more firmly on the side of commercial telecom, essentially how to convince them that we should be shifting to something like municipal fiber.
Mm. Okay, great. Here's the way to do it. That you say, look, you're acting as if we have some choice between the free market on one hand and government control on the other. Mm. Actually, what's happened is we have a series of private governments because these companies have divided up the country and tend not to compete with each other. And they set the prices and they decide who's going to get what, and they also decide not to upgrade. Their goal, which makes sense in the capitalist market, is only profit taking. If a city gets into this, their goal is service. You don't ask a bridge whether it's profitable. It's there to make sure everybody can get across the river. Similarly, municipal fiber is there as a public option to make sure that everybody gets a chance at a respectable life. And it's just like water. It's just like electricity. It's increasingly crucial to life. But tell them that the choice they think they're being offered between a private market and government control is actually false. They're getting the worst of both worlds.
All right. Andy, thanks so much for that call. So this isn't a case where somebody might say, whoa, 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 I'm suspicious of having the government control the means of communication
right.
across the internet,
yeah.
right?
In fact, the model that really works and works very well in Sweden and South Korea and Japan is for the government just to build the equivalent of a street grid, just blank fiber, they call it dark fiber, without the lasers in it, reaching every home and business, and then lease that out to private actors.
Interesting. So what stands in
service?
I see. So what stands in the way from that happening right now here in the United States?
Shenanigans. Political shenanigans.
A technical term.
Political shenanigans. In 19 states, it's either difficult or impossible for cities to do this because the state legislature has just declared that this would be unfair to the private companies. And, you know, the companies essentially don't want to compete. Yeah. That's the trouble. In the states where this is allowed, like in Colorado, purple state, and by the way, this is largely happening in Republican areas. This is not a Democratic idea. 60% of the counties have voted for municipal fiber, and that's a home of a lot of cable. But they just decided we don't want to be left out of the 21st century, and we want to make sure we're paying a reasonable price. We're paying what the service should cost, which really is more like something 25 to 40 bucks is what people pay in Asian nations and the Nordics.
Here's what I'm still having trouble getting my head around. Why wouldn't a Comcast? I mean, let's talk about Cambridge, for example, right? So your one choice is Comcast. But why wouldn't Comcast want to upgrade to fiber to be competitive with the rest of the world?
Why would they?
Yeah.
I mean, look at it from their perspective. This morning, I wrote a check to Comcast for $107.45 because I get just internet. I don't want a bundle. And that's how much it costs in Cambridge.
Right.
That's extraordinary.
Yep.
And they're under no pressure from competition. There's nobody else offering service and no oversight. So you add all that up and their capital expenditure as a percentage of their revenues is down this year to 14%. And they're planning to make more money from the same infrastructure. There's absolutely no reason for them to upgrade.
I see. All right. So talk a little bit about towns and cities, a few of them sprinkled around the United States that are actually taking matters into their own hands and making this work.
It's a tale of courage. I got to say, there are 800 places, cities and cooperatives and groups around the country who are deciding that this is worth it. And they're either raising the money or floating bonds. Some communities decide to tax themselves. It turns out to be a very worthwhile investment. It just pays back slowly. So if you're a media company like Verizon or AT&T, may not make sense for you to do this because you need 18% returns every quarter for your Wall Street investors. For the places that are doing this, this is a real point of pride. It turns out to be the number one thing on businesses' lists when they're thinking about moving to communities, whether there's adequate connectivity, not only for themselves, but for their employees who might want to telecommute.
All right. Well, on this subject, I want to introduce another another voice in this conversation, William Hiller. He is a town selectman in Otis, Massachusetts. He's serving on the technology committee, and he heads Otis Fiber, the town's municipal internet provider. And William Hiller, good to have you. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks. Hey, Susan.
Hey, Phil. Nice to hear your voice.
Now, you guys know each other, of course. William features in your book.
Oh, largely.
Largely. All right. So, Mr. Hiller, tell me about the impact on Otis of this project, of the town's fiber project, if you will.
Well, we're still in our infancy. Right now, we have probably close to 300 homes lit up. This is fiber to the home. 1 gig up, 1 gig down. You know, in being a selectman, I don't normally get good phone calls, but a lot of people have called and just expressed how grateful they are to have this service.
And why did you want to take this on? What did you see as so important about it?
Overwhelmingly, the town wanted it. As Susan says, it's, in my opinion, it's as important as electricity. Moving forward is, you know, as we go into the future. We have kids from school sitting out in the parking lot at night in front of the library just to do their homework because they need the internet out here. If the only means of connection out here is via hotspot. So if you don't have that, you have nothing.
Wow. So what about cost, Mr. Hiller? Tell me about that. How does that work? For a small town, Otis is a population of about 1,600, I think?
Well, we have 1,600 residences. That's homes.
Yep.
So it's going to be difficult, and to be honest with you, we don't know yet. We're so early into this. We're into phase two, actually phase three of 11 phases. And the costs, we have models, but we really don't know. We're running 80 miles of fiber. We have 2,600 some odd poles. And one of the big variables is what's called the take rate. So we have 1,600 potential customers. How many customers we will actually have is a huge question.
I see. So, Susan Crawford, what do you hear in William Hiller's story here about Otis?
He's early in a story. Mm-hmm. We are seeing in countries that are really used to this, take rate is north of 70%.
Wow.
Because it's just viewed as a utility. Of course you need this.
Right.
Because it's unusual in Otis and because there have been delays, the town does not control those poles, and so they've had to wait to get access to them. It's a like operatic drama. Pole attachment turns out to be really bloody stuff. So it's taken a while, and so you know, you've got to accustom people to it and make sure it's offered at the right price. But they're taking the right step, and the town, as Mr. Hiller said, overwhelmingly voted for this at a town meeting, and there are lots of other places in Massachusetts that have done the same thing.
Right. Now, is this something that is more doable in a small town like Otis compared to, I don't know, a larger metropolitan area like Boston?
Actually, it's likely a little harder in Otis because telecom really works on economies of scale.
Yeah.
And if you've got a sparsely populated place with long distances, you really have to make sure that every customer signs up. In a place that has 30% apartment buildings, let's say, you can get an entire building relatively rapidly, and those economies of scale really work in your favor. That's what's made it so expensive to ensure that the middle of the United States gets very good high-speed internet access, because it's expensive to do it.
So, William Hiller, final question for you. In terms of the challenge that you're facing out there in making this happen, what could the federal government have done or should do to make this whole thing more doable? What kind of policies are lacking? Can you give me a sense there?
Well, first, I would really like to thank the governor of Massachusetts and the state. Without their support, none of this would actually happen. We do have some additional funding coming from the federal government, which is certainly going to help. But a lot of regulation. We're seeing extraordinary costs from Make Ready.
That's
probably
the polls.
A fifth of our construction costs were dedicated to getting the poles ready to attach fiber. And then moving forward, operating costs, again, attaching to those poles is a significant expense yearly. Even though we pay for the poles in many cases, we still have to pay to attach to them.
All right. So money, obviously, is one of the
It's significant.
Yeah.
But that's also...
So if
that's
the federal
also,
government could jump in there, it would be very helpful.
Well, William Hiller, he's an Otis Town selectman serving on the Technology Committee, and he heads Otis Fiber, the town's municipal internet provider. William Hiller, thanks so much for joining us today.
You're welcome.
Really
thanks
appreciate
very much
it.
Again, Susan. Nice to talk to you.
Nice to talk to you, too.
So, Susan, you write at one point in your book that once you have the idea that fiber is important, the other steps fall into place. It's only money. But it's a lot of money, right? I mean, I think
potentially, but we spend a lot of money on defense. We spend a lot of money on other things. This amount of money, what's actually happening is that we're losing money as a country by not making this upgrade. We're paying rent to about five companies that are doing extremely well while sort of dumbing down our own populace. Because Americans don't travel, they may not be aware of just how bad the situation is.
Right.
And they're sort of content with how things are going. But it's a tragedy. There is some baby Einstein, some baby Mozart out there who has no access or terrible access and can't get the kinds of support they really deserve to lead a thriving life.
And this really raises the specter of this sort of technological haves versus the technological have-nots, right? I mean, we're really in a situation where that's already beginning to happen, I guess.
Well, certainly in the U.S., and so turn now to China, where they're planning to connect 80% of their homes to fiber optic and 5G, these very fast wireless services, they know that they need to create a giant middle-class market for all of their goods and services, and they see this as part of it, along with high-speed rail. In the United States, we seem content to just leave behind somewhere between a third and a half of Americans who don't have adequate internet access, and the rest of us are paying too much.
Hmm. Well, that's Susan Crawford. She's a professor at Harvard Law School. Her new book is Fiber, the Coming Tech Revolution and Why Americans Might and Why America Might Miss It. There's a lot more information about the book at our website, radioboston.org. Professor Susan Crawford, thanks so much for coming in. Thanks for the book, an important subject. I really appreciate hearing from you.
I appreciate being here.
Listeners, stay with us. There's more ahead. I'm Anthony Brooks. This is Radio Boston.
Wait a second.
Don't hit the skip button.
I mean, we know you do it.
We just wanted to take a second here because you already know how to download a podcast.
But you might have a question about some of the other technology you use, and we think we can help.
WBUR is working on a new show, and we're here to answer your tech questions, whether it's hardware-related,
software-related, social, even ethical.
Just click that little phone-shaped app on your cell phone and give us a call. Leave a message, 617-917-4717.
Give it a try. 617-917-4717.
Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Anthony Brooks. When Boston Magazine put out its list of the city's top 50 restaurants, it was a celebration of more than 100 Boston chefs and restaurateurs. But here's a fact that's not worthy of celebration. There was only one black person on that list. That, according to WBUR's food columnist and restaurant owner Irene Lee. One person in a city that has some 40 black-owned restaurants, from Roxbury to Dorchester, from Jamaica Plain to the South End. So in honor of Black History Month, State Rep China Tyler of Boston has sponsored the second annual Boston Black Restaurant Challenge, which encourages Bostonians to eat at four black-owned restaurants in the month of February. It's a way to try to level the playing field for non-white restaurant owners, especially in parts of the city where mentorship, access to capital, and community wealth might not be in abundance. Douglas Williams is an African-American chef and restaurant owner who's here to talk about this. Welcome to Radio Boston. It's great to have you, Douglas Williams.
Thank you for having me. It's a pleasure.
His restaurant is Mida, an Italian-inspired eatery in the Roxbury neighborhood that borders the South End. Tell us first, from your perspective, why the Boston Black Restaurant Challenge is important.
Well, it gives the public a ability to focus on a thing that has happened in the past, and now we can do right and just you know, just spread our wings a bit and go out to the fringes of, you know, our neighborhoods or other neighborhoods and say, there is actually some really phenomenal food on parts that I would have never looked for. It's really just to focus our sights and give us some other opportunities as far as culinarians and excited foodies.
Right. So I understand you've joined the challenge. Tell us how. What is Mi Da doing?
We have a little menu that has two drinks, two extra special little food items that when you buy them or when you purchase them or enjoy them, I guess you could say, those contributions go towards the ACLU and BECMA, BECMA being the Black Economic Council of Massachusetts.
I mentioned in the introduction some of the challenges that Black restaurant owners might face. I'd love to get your perspective on that. What kind of challenges have you in particular faced?
Oh, man. Well, I hope it's not any different or more than anybody else with a restaurant has, because it sucks already, you know, to have so many, you know, things against you. Profit margins. Everybody's obviously talking about labor and staff productions, but it's, you know, if you are a Black gentleman or a Black woman or a person of color that owns a restaurant, some people get the strange idea that only certain people can go to that restaurant or certain people can enjoy themselves in a certain neighborhood. That's the biggest challenge, is getting people to understand that everyone is welcome. There's no sort of, you know, strange belief that only people of the neighborhood, only people that look like the owner or the employees can go there. That is the biggest challenge.
I get it. So in terms of Mi Da, you're in Roxbury, but you're right there on the border of the South End, which of course has exploded in recent decades and is, you know, a place where there are lots of incredible restaurants.
Attention. Yeah. Attention,
yeah. And
is
lots
being focused.
Of attention. Yeah. Do you find it's a challenge getting people to just sort of venture just a couple more blocks toward your restaurant?
Yeah. Well, we thought about, you know, that Mass Ave as being a little blockade. But then when we started to say, oh, it's not a gray area of South End and Roxbury, it's a rainbow. It's an entryway into extending South End, but also Roxbury extends. And we just say it's this blending and this mending, as it should have been, as it always should have been. It is great for economics, is great for just collaboration, and is great for just general understanding and perspective. And once you have that, a neighborhood mending together cannot be stopped.
You know, the Boston Black Restaurant Challenge, it sounds like it's all about supporting Black-owned restaurants. But in hearing you talk, I feel like you're making a case that this is really about supporting the whole city in some way.
I think that's what, you know, Black History Month is anyway. It's about inclusion. It's not saying if you are not of color or if you are not of a certain whatever, that you can't be a part of it. This is about putting a spotlight and a focus and an attention on catching up to where we should have been. Yeah. You know, catching up to the togetherness and the inclusion that everyone has, I think, feels in their heart. But just there's some confusion. And that's allowed. But now it's time to put that behind us, celebrate everyone, celebrate Black History Month, celebrate the Black Restaurant Challenge, and just visit restaurants. If you only want to do one Black-owned restaurant, you're not sure, or it's like feels weird to you, just go to a restaurant, and eventually you will stumble upon someone that takes their hospitality seriously, and they will lead you to the next and the next and the next. And that's what we're trying to promote.
Lots of ways, of course, to observe, celebrate Black History Month. Mm-hmm. But why this way? Through food and restaurants. I mean, I feel like I know the answer.
Because it's the best way.
I figured you would say that.
You know, like not everybody can, you know, not everybody can travel to a foreign land. Not everybody has a time to read so many books. Not everybody has time to do everything. People are busy, but everybody has time for food. You know, just go enjoy the celebration of people that own restaurants, because it is, as you know, the hardest business in the world. I mean, you could have Fortune 500 company CEOs come in and they can't touch a restaurant. They couldn't make it last more than 3 months. And it is so difficult. Now you add on, you know, someone feeling like they are underserved or disparaged or historically not supported. And then you add a restaurant to that. It is a big achievement, but it's a big achievement for everyone. And that's what I think we're celebrating.
Finally, tell us a little about the food at Mi Da. If we were to go into Mi Da today, what can we expect this week?
Oh, you're not even ready. So
and by the way, I love Italian food.
So good, good.
This is my favorite
you
question.
Better. Well, you don't have a, that's not an option. The first thing, start off with focaccia. We make it every day in-house. It's garlic butter. It's a delicious olive oil. It gets served crispy and just oily and delicious and crunchy and has all those textures that you love. Bucatini amatriciana. spicy tomato sauce, beautiful, delicious noodles with little holes in them all the way through so you suck up all the sauce. We have a pork milanese. We have a beautiful chicken dish. We make all our gelato in-house. You don't want to stop, but your stomach is only big, so I'd obviously say bring friends.
All right. Well, you've made me really hungry. I'm going to eat Italian.
I was
going to
bring something. I just didn't have time.
Well, I'll have to stop by Mida this evening. So that's Chef Douglas Williams, owner of Mida Restaurant in Roxbury, right on the South End border. He was talking about the second annual Boston Black Restaurant Challenge, which encourages Bostonians to eat at 4 black-owned restaurants in the month of February. And you can find the list, by the way, of the city's black-owned restaurants at radioboston.org. Chef Douglas Williams, thank you so much.
Absolute pleasure. Thank you for having me.
God, I'm hungry. That's our show for today. Radio Boston is a production of 90.9 WBUR, Boston's NPR news station. Our show was produced by Jamie Bologna, Chris Sitterick, Paris Alston, Zoe Mitchell, and Eve Zukoff. Tim Skog is our technical director. Our executive producer is Hitesh Hathi. I'm Anthony Brooks. Join us again tomorrow for more Radio Boston.
Wait, don't go yet.
Because you already know how to download a podcast.
But if you have any other tech or life question, maybe we can help you. WBUR is working on a new show, and we need your tech questions.
Or maybe your parents' questions. Just click that little phone-shaped app on your cell phone and leave a message. 617-917-4717.
Yes, we know. How quaint. A phone call. But give it a try. 617-917-4717.